Before we get started, I really would like to extend a thank you to Anthony Wong and Russell Leong. Aside from giving me this opportunity to talk in front of you beautiful people, I really think that they have done a lot for Asian American studies and Asian American students. And I hope to, I hope to continue in their footsteps as I hopefully become more successful. All right. So, without further ado, Kung Fu community, my name is Raymond Fong. Unfortunately, not Raymond Romano. But, so my academic background, Anthony went over it briefly. I grew up in San Francisco, went to University of Arizona for East Asian Studies, and I focused there on Chinese history, modern Chinese history, so like the 1940s to about 2010, let's say. And then I went to graduate school at Teachers College, Columbia University, and my thesis there was how families who lived in 8th Avenue, Brooklyn, which is Brooklyn Chinatown, how their lives kind of revolved around the SHSAT, which is a specialized high school exam. All right. So my other interests include food, which is usually irrelevant, but it really helped me get a lot of research in when I was in China. So we'll be continuing with this. Oh, sorry. My martial arts background. I've been doing martial arts since third grade, and I started out doing wushu, the performance martial art, or performance kung fu. And then I did chuala fut, which is southern traditional kung fu, in middle school and in high school. And then after high school, I stopped for a little bit, and I did some MMA. And then after coming back to New York, or after going to New York, I did chuala fut again, and I'm also doing Muay Thai. So I've seen a lot of things in martial arts. I'm not saying I'm good. I've just seen a lot of things. Yeah. Okay, so actually, this project was meant for my master's thesis. And even though it turned into something else later on, this was the preliminary question. And this was actually the cause for this presentation to happen. And the question that my research revolved around was, what role does martial arts schools play in the lives of participants, and also how does general society perceive the school and respectively the participants? That's just a fancy way of saying I was really interested on how people view the martial arts school, the martial arts culture, the people who are in the martial arts school. Because, you know, in Chinese they have a term, they use the term culture to kind of describe their social acceptability as well. So like, oh, that person lacks culture, or that person has a lot of culture. I wanted to see how people saw the kung fu people. Were they seen as athletes? Were they seen as people who wasted their lives? Were they seen as people who were really deep in philosophy? I just wanted to see what they thought. And like any good research question, it kind of changes something else. And for this presentation, I'm gonna illuminate the diversity of ways in which this art is taught and interacted with. And despite having a relatively predictable curriculum, kung fu schools dynamically coexist with their communities, both shaping and being shaped by their communities. So the first part of that, kung fu schools don't just exist in one way. You know, I think a lot of people, they think of kung fu schools and have a certain image. And today I'm going to talk about the different ways they exist. Okay. And the second part of this is I'm going to talk about their relationship with communities. And it's not just that, oh, the kung fu schools are here and thus this happens. The contribution is both ways. So communities shape kung fu schools, and kung fu schools shape communities. All right. So I'm sorry if this brings back any memories from school, but I'd like you to maybe talk to a partner to your left or right. We're going to start off with some defining exercises. I want you to ask yourself or your partner, what is kung fu? What is the definition for kung fu that you have? And what is a kung fu school? Okay? So I'm going to give you guys just like a minute, and then we'll come back, and then I'll call on a couple of you, or volunteer, preferably volunteer. And then I just want to hear what you guys think. So who has something that they heard was interesting or just want to share what they thought? Yes.
Well, what she talked about, the word kung fu in Chinese, it meant to me, it's not meaning that something is you work hard at.
Mm-hmm.
When you have good kung fu, then you're good at something you're good at.
Absolutely.
What does the word kung fu in Chinese, which stands from a lot of cultural context?
Absolutely, absolutely. Anyone else have anything interesting?
I was always told it meant movement, or the art of movement.
Mm-hmm.
And a kung fu school is in the U.S. is a dojo. So that's where you go study. You've got a sensei. You pay your dues. You learn the art.
Absolutely.
Yeah. On that point right here, he mentioned something interesting. He said Kung Fu schools kind of represent, if I mess this up, you know, it's pretty, it represents like a type of culture or background where it actually originates from China. So certain Kung Fu schools are different from each other.
Wow. Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, absolutely. All you guys have correct answers. This is not being wrong or right. Oh, do you have anything you want to share?
Yeah, we had an interesting discussion on what is a school.
Right.
We were like, does it need to have a physical space to be a school? And we were like, maybe yes, maybe no. What if it was in a park? Mm-hmm. How would we meet up? And then Will was talking a little bit about the history of how people used to gather.
Mm-hmm. Village self-defense societies.
Right, right. Oof, bringing back some trauma from the defining terms in graduate school. All right, we're getting in there. Okay, so those are all very good points, and I think everyone's correct. So my point by asking this is it's very important for us to define our terms. So for this presentation, Kung Fu is any martial art with strong historical ties to China as recognized by the school/practitioners. Recognized, I'm going to put it in big letters because I know that there's some discussions that karate and taekwondo have roots in China. So technically, if I just said Chinese martial arts, there might be some confusion there. For this presentation, we're just going to focus on those that recognize themselves as being part of Chinese martial arts. Okay? And a Kung Fu school is any space that formally teaches any form of Kung Fu. Okay, so when I say form of Kung Fu, I don't just mean your typical, forms, weapons, stuff like that. I also mean, things like shuai jiao, like wrestling, Chinese wrestling. I also mean lion dancing, maybe even like Peking opera. Okay, those are all, to me, forms of Kung Fu. And so for this presentation, these are the kind of parameters we're going to be using. And also, I forgot to mention this in the beginning. If you have any questions at all, please feel free to raise your hand, jump in. I hate to hear myself talk for too long anyway, so heavy, much needed break. All right. So, Kung Fu, you guys were talking about this earlier. Just for clarity, because I know a lot of the people who are watching this might not speak Chinese. Kung Fu, actually, in Chinese, I think, the best word to describe the meaning of it is effort. And so, in English, it means Chinese martial arts. I practice Kung Fu, right? Pretty simple. But in Chinese, the effort part is much more emphasized. So, you must put in a great deal of Kung Fu in order to become a pool noodle chef, right? You must put in a great deal of Kung Fu to become a taxi driver in New York City, right? These are things that require Kung Fu. It requires hard work, requires effort to accomplish, okay? So another term that I would like to define is Wushu, okay? So in English, in America, and I believe probably most non-China places, Wushu refers to a specific kind of Kung Fu that focuses on performance. And this type of Kung Fu came about post-communist revolution, and the goal was to take the best parts of all the different types of Kung Fu and make it into, for Wushu, the most beautiful performance martial art that existed. And they did a similar thing and tried to take all the best fighting moves from Kung Fu and turn it into Sanda, which is like Chinese kickboxing. Okay, so in English, simple, I do Wushu. You do Wushu. We did Wushu. Everyone loves Wushu. Okay, and the Chinese meaning is martial arts. And so boxing is an American Wushu. Karate is a Japanese Wushu. Okay, so this just for clarity's sake. Anyone recognize that guy?
Yeah. It Man the Rape?
Yes, yes. He was such a jerk. He was such a bad person. Boxing people are lovely people, a little rocky. But anyways, all right. And the last thing, probably most important for my project, community. Can be any one of these three things, but in this presentation, I'll mainly be focusing on number 2 and 3, okay? Number 1, common interest between people. Number 2, a common ecology and locality. Number 3, a common social system or structure. Very simple, okay? But I think, especially for my presentation, locality is going to be important, and social system and structure are going to be very, very important. All right. So, to argue my point, I'm going to be talking about quite a few different Kung Fu schools, and for those of you that are watching from a different kung fu school, maybe if I didn't mention you, very sorry. These are the kung fu schools that I am familiar with and I had an opportunity to do research with. So I apologize if it's not as comprehensive as people might want it, okay? Remember, I am from San Francisco. So, moving on. San Francisco, California. San Francisco has a 35% Asian population, totaling around 300,000. Large percentage of Chinese descent in the USA, and it totals out around 150,000. This is second to only New York City. This is important because San Francisco is like 7x7, and New York is might as well be a small country. Right, so San Francisco has a huge Chinese population, and anyone that maybe has dabbled in Asian American studies knows that they have a very rich Chinese American history because of the gold rush, right? Okay. So the first person and the first school that we're going to be talking about is the Jingmo Athletic Association. This, has anyone here seen the movie Fearless with Jet Li? A few people? Okay, okay. How about the new one with Philip Ng, Birth of a Dragon? Birth of a Dragon? Anyways, it was a movie about Bruce Lee. And so Siva Wong Jack Man is famous for fighting Bruce Lee. Unfortunately, because he's famous for that, if you search up his name, that's the only thing that comes up. But his school used to be on 880 Pacific Avenue in San Francisco and existed from the early 1960s up into the late 70s. And after that, he moved to a like a rental, like one of those art spaces you rent to do dance or ballet, like once a week, twice a week type of thing. So he rented out that space after that. And it was at Fort Mason. So let's get into some unique things about Sifu Wong Jack Man. First of all, unlike the movie, he's a very nice guy. That's first of all. Okay, but second of all, you know, in Chinatown at that time, there were very few northern style martial arts. So, you know, those stereotypes that you hear, or not stereotypes, but those things that you hear where, you know, certain styles, they don't kick above the waist, or they kind of have really strong stances, don't really kick a lot. That was the opposite of what Wong Jack Man was. He had a lot of kicks, crazy movement, very flexible. I don't know if you can see it, but this is him doing his splits on two chairs. You know what I mean? And this, if you are familiar with Kung Fu, is a very northern stance. You know what I mean? So he was very special in that way. He was probably the only northern style in Chinatown at that time, San Francisco Chinatown, okay? And what's really interesting about his school wasn't only that he was a northern practitioner, okay, but his school was also used as a very social community space, okay? So this video is going to be a video of two of his students back in the day. And you can tell it's back in the day by the haircut. And they're going to be doing a sparring form. I just want you guys to see kind of this. If you guys practice martial arts, the northern flavor that's in there. If you actually look at it, it's very very acrobatic, which is very contrary to a lot of Southern styles and a lot of stereotypically traditional things that you see today. And those two were Wong Jack Man's students. They were not Wong Jack Man. One of them was Arthur Chin, and the other one was Ricky Wing. I believe they still teach. So if you guys want to look them up, you know, they might be there. So this is a quote from Reverend Norman Fong from the Growing Up in San Francisco Chinatown. All of us kids hung out here at the 880. This is where we made pretend that we were kung fu stars. Friday nights, you could see everybody here, maybe 100 guys, and then sometimes we would come out here to practice, just practicing, you know? And sometimes we would even fight each other, and sometimes we would even hurt. Man, 880s, it was fun. It was all guys hanging out, and we feel good about ourselves. Okay, so the main point of me putting up that quote is that Wong Jack Man's school wasn't just a school that they learned martial arts at. That's where they hung out. That's where they socialized. Okay. And I talked to another one of his older students who preferred to not be named. And he told me that there used to be dances at Wong Chai Man's studio. I can't imagine how fun that is. And I believe he said he doesn't know exactly why, but I believe he believed that the reason why they had dances at his school was, first, he was pretty laid back, so he didn't really care. But more importantly, the floor was a nice dancing floor. And so that's how it came to be. And so from when he opens in the 1960s, he was also a waiter at the Jackson Cafe. He wasn't the most successful businessman, as you can see. And unfortunately, he had to leave his space in Chinatown involuntarily. Like I think the formal word was an eviction. Something about raising. I don't know, but it got too expensive, basically, is what happened. And, unfortunately, it had to move to Fort Mason later on. And now it does primarily line dance under Ricky Wing, the guy that was in the video. And, it's really interesting to see this school because even though it took the form of a business, right? Like, if you look at it, people went there to learn Kung Fu, they paid him, he taught them Kung Fu, right? There is a lot of other things that went on in the school that is not business-like. For example, having dances without profiting off of it. That is the worst business decision that you could ever make, right? And so it's really interesting to see how this school went, the trajectory of this school, the growth and the not growth, and also the way it was utilized by its students. Okay, so now I'm going to play a quick clip of Ricky Wing and the Lion Dance team doing their thing. As you can see, they're much more focused on line dance. And actually, I went to their YouTube channel, and all of the videos were line dance. So they focus much more now on line dance. Also, these videos are not difficult to find. They're all easy to find on YouTube. I don't have a secret stash of old videos anywhere. I don't have Kung Fu connections that are sending me old videos, on cassette tapes. These are just all on YouTube. So these are all findable. All right, next one, we're going to be talking about Tat Wong Kung Fu. So Grandmaster Tat Wong, I'm sure you guys have heard of him probably. He has a whole bunch of schools. He has 8 official schools, 4 in the USA, 2 in Brazil, and 1 in Chile. And this is not including schools that have, the instructor at the school has learned from him and then opened their own school but decided not to, I think, be part of the franchise. And those schools are also very numerous. There's a whole bunch of them in Brazil, oddly enough, but... Anyway, so there's a whole bunch of schools that source themselves from Tat Mao Wong. He studied under Lee Kun Hong. He does Charlie Futt. He studied under Lee Kun Hong. Lee Kun Hong was a pretty big contributor to the Kung Fu scene in America, too. And he had a lot of prestigious titles, one of which is he's the head coach of the USA Wushu team. And he's also been recognized by the mayor for a few things. He came up in San Francisco. I think he came to San Francisco around... late 1960s or early 1970s. And for those of you who are from that era, I think this will be a little bit of a flashback. And he got famous initially because he did this segment called Kung Fu Theater, which showed Kung Fu styles, Kung Fu moves in between horror movies. So we're going to play that video for you real quick.
Welcome to Kung Fu Theater. I'm your host, Tat Mao Wong. Today's movie is Bloody Fist. This exciting adventure story set in China has plenty of martial action. After learning karate and judo while exiled in Japan, this movie bad guy returns to protect his opium smuggling ring. Then be sure to stick around, because later on Kung Fu Theater, we'll be joined by our guest, Kung Fu Master. See for Henry Look, he's a Xing Yi style. And now on to our movie, The Bloody Fist. Ha! Ha! Ha!
I feel bad for the guy, man. He had to make that whole thing just after doing a form. That's rough. It's hard on the cardio. All right. Yeah, that's the platform where he became popular. And he did a lot of interesting things, but most people just see him as kind of like a kung fu mogul. Like he just has a lot of money, he's really good at business, but a lot of people don't see the other side, and I was lucky enough to see the other side. So Presidio Middle School in San Francisco is in the Richmond District, and his old school, I believe his headquarters school, used to be right next to Presidio. And I clearly remember my friends going to Tat Wong's after school. Convenient, of course, and their friends are doing it. Why wouldn't you want to do it? So a lot of people were going to his school just out of Presidio, just for fun. Okay, and he became a huge part of the community because I remember very distinctly walking in Richmond and always seeing their uniform everywhere. You know what I mean? Because you're there, so your mom's going to take you shopping, you're going to get something to eat, you're going to get some bubble tea. I don't know what you're going to do, but you're going to do something in that area. And it was really cool. It was a big part of that area for a very long time. And even when they moved to Clement, which is their current location, it's huge, by the way. It's a beautiful school. They still have a very heavy impact on the local community. And he, even though he's not there per se, his school is definitely there. Like the UC kids walking around, and they're always wearing the Tat Wong uniform. It's a cut off. It's like really shiny. It's yellow usually. It's just really cool. And I feel like a lot of people don't see that part of Tat Mao Wong. People only see his business accomplishments, and they don't see that his schools are really from bottom up. They're part of the communities that they're in. When you ask anyone, especially from the Richmond district, where's a good kung fu school? They're always going to say Tat Mao Wong. Well, I don't know if they're going to say it's a good one, but it's definitely one of the more recognizable ones in the area. Yes.
Where in Brazil is schools?
Where in Brazil?
Yeah.
To be honest, I have no idea. I'm sorry. I just got from one of his students that he has that school. I'm sorry. But he does have quite a heavy following in Brazil. I'm not too sure why, but I have seen videos where he's training with a lot of Brazilian students. So that's the middle school. And also a lot of people don't talk about his contributions to the overseas kung fu scene. Him and Lee Kun Hong did a lot to make these tournaments, which I've been to one of the tournaments, and is the best organized kung fu tournament out there right now. And he doesn't have any funding from the government. He doesn't have any funding from China. He's doing it out of his own pocket. And he did this a long time ago when really it was kind of a... It was very challenging at that time. And through this, he also united... Or not unite, I shouldn't say united. He also made it basically socially acceptable to kind of show your kung fu stuff on film. Because back then, it was super taboo. They didn't even like you taking pictures of them doing kung fu at that time. And Tat Mao Wong kind of broke that barrier. You would not believe how difficult it is to try to get, at that time, different kung fu masters to go to Florida to have a tournament. You know what I mean? And he made it happen. And we're going to see a quick clip with him and his sifu, Lee Kun Hong. And at one of the tournaments.
Choli Fat is a Nam Pai very famous kung fu. Choli Fat's kung fu is focused in the bok kick. His specialty is Chang Kiao Dai Ma.
Master Lee said that Choli Fat is one of the famous southern style. The special thing about the Choli Fat is really a long arm. Really practical self-defense technique.
在廣東嚟嘅，佢發源地喺廣東。
Master Lee explained that the Choli Fat style original from the Canton province of China, so it is one of the famous southern style in the south of China.
首先好多謝你咁欣賞我哋兩個人嘅學校。 嘅學生，咁我兩師徒咧都好嚴格咁樣去訓練嗰啲徒弟啊，同埋咧就我哋唔淨止係訓練啲徒弟係功夫嘅，同埋訓練我哋嘅中國嘅傳統嘅禮貌。咁我啲徒弟 同埋阿黃繼茂啲徒弟咧，佢出嚟都係好有武術嘅精神，同埋好有禮貌嘅。
Actually, both school from Master Lee training the student is we training every day. It's not you know just because of the event. Actually, we training every day. The attitudes and the spirit. We want to bring out the true martial art. But myself, I want to say that in the reason my student can be that sharp, it's not because of myself. It's because my sifu, my master. So you know, I learn it from him. I want to teach the same thing to my student. That's you know from.You know, bottom of my heart.
Yeah, if you noticed, well, you know, it's hard, but there were so many non-Chinese practitioners in that video. And also, a lot of the practitioners that were there, a lot of the performers that were there were also different styles. And again, this is just kind of to illustrate the level that Tat Mao Wong kind of took Kung Fu to and how he's...while being kind of a business mogul, kind of being the opposite, more or less, of Wong Jack Man, he's been able to contribute to the local community, while also, you know, to the overall Kung Fu community, arguably internationally. All right, so another fun question, guys. All right, so for this time, we're going to mix it up a little bit. I'm not going to ask you to talk to your partner. We're just going to have an open discussion about this. What are some of the differences that exist between opening a Kung Fu school in Tucson versus San Francisco?Tucson is a place in Arizona. The main point is that it's not super urban. Okay. So take a few seconds thinking about that. If you have anything come to mind, please raise your hand. What's up?
It's the dark of Chinese community in Tucson.
The what?
The lack of Chinese community in Tucson.
Absolutely. 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 And how do you think that might like affect, you know, the opening of a school?
Well, I guess people wouldn't be as open to the idea of opening a Kung Fu school because it's foreign to them.
Right.
Or okay. In San Francisco, you know, there's a big Chinese top community.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers?
Sensei.
Okay.
People that would teach.
Oh, I see.
Parents to teach. Yeah.
Right. Just like less of them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So kind of like a lack of just people resources.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other things?
Maybe just the location...The way people get there is different. Like in a big city, people just can walk to it next to the school, and here you have to ride there.
Right.
And it's different. That makes it, I don't know how it makes a difference, but it's different.
That's a very New York thing to bring up. That's a very good point. Anyone else got any cool ideas they want to throw out there? It doesn't have to be Tucson. It could be, what's a suburb of the East Coast? Like Virginia? I don't know. I've never been there. But yeah, any other suburb? Anyone have any other things they want to throw out there?
Well, lack of interest. If they're not aware of that culture, it's really foreign to them, and it may not mean anything to them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you see that a lot with, especially with lion dance in the suburb schools. The lion dance is very... It just doesn't look like a lion dance, and I feel like a lot of the students kind of think of it more as a cultural practice than it is as a martial art. Cool. All right, so moving on. We're going to Tucson. How did you guys know? All right, so Tucson is an interesting place. It has a relatively large Filipino and Vietnamese population, and it has, even though the numbers aren't super high, it has a pretty significant Chinese-American history, but...At the same point, it doesn't have super vibrant communities, right? Like, they don't have anything close to a Chinatown there. It's not like a whole row, maybe, of Chinese restaurants or a whole row of Chinese businesses. That doesn't exist out there. It kind of does in Phoenix, but definitely not in Tucson. And there are about 15,000 Asians in Tucson, Arizona, and about 4,000 of this number is Chinese. So this number, though, needs to be taken with a grain of salt because...I was told by one of my professors that they count the Chinese students at universities as part of this population. So you have to keep that in mind. Okay, but 15,000 isn't super low. It's not super low. Okay. So now we're going to talk about Sifu Augustine Fong. And he has had a Wing Chun school in Tucson since the 1960s, back in the cowboy days. Okay.A little bit later than cowboy days, but okay. But you know, but it's interesting about his school is that because the quality of instruction is pretty high, and a lot of Wing Chun people just go out there to seek him out. Okay, and the student makeup is namely not Chinese. Okay, but he has like people from Europe coming over to go visit him, do seminars with him. He has a, I'll talk about that in the next slide. But he has, you know, it's a very high level Wing Chun practitioner, and he opened his school up in Tucson. And when I asked him, you know, about like how come, you know, he came to Tucson, he's like, politics. Just, you don't need to deal with politics. Because especially at the time, you know, I'm sure those of you who are more familiar with Kung Fu history in America, at that time it was very gang related, and he just didn't want to deal with all that. You go to San Francisco or New York, you have to deal with a lot of different types of obstacles, you know, aside from even politics, like even just money or, you know, trying to get somewhere on the queue. Like, you never know. You know what I mean? So that was his main reason for opening in Tucson. And he's been there ever since. All right. And now we're going to see like a quick demo by him. He's also a super nice guy. And he also speaks pretty good English, so if you guys want to get in contact with him, it's very easy.
This is Wing Chun Applications, Mr. Augustine Fong and Mr. Tony Frigetti. What is Wing Chun Applications?
Actually, you know, Wing Chun is the style that was studied by the late film star Bruce Lee in Hong Kong. So it's very famous after, of course, Bruce Lee made it so big in the movies. Wing Chun requires this type of skilled sensitivity of the hands and arms to move in and be able to control the attacker and get in and make your touch. Sifu Fong is one of the foremost authorities on Wing Chun in North America.
It's really fascinating.
This is the kind of training that's used by a lot of professional football teams now. Their linemen need to know how to use their hands in this way. Although they may not throw the guy down and kick him, at least.
That would be a penalty. But I can understand the correlation there.
Wing Chun also uses its legs. Sifu Fong is demonstrating a few of the leg work takedowns. This is sometimes called sticking hands, meaning that he sticks to the opponent's. Well, he stuck to the opponent.
As you can see, this video is a little older. I could have done without the music, but you know, it's a very good demonstration. And anyone, you know, who's seen Wing Chun, he's a very high level practitioner. And so what's interesting about his school is that, ironically, he's very his interaction with the local community is very limited. He used to do lion dancing for the benevolent associations out there. Benevolent associations are like the business associations, like they were meant as a support system for Chinese immigrants that didn't know how to speak English. They would like lend them money and help them with legal stuff. But obviously, with technology and kind of the modern society today, the benevolent association's role has kind of diminished. So, you know, he hasn't line danced for them for a while. But that's pretty much the only performance I know he does with the community. You know, Augustine Fong is very, very interested, and it's almost, I mean, it's definitely his life goal is in spreading Wing Chun, and cares deeply about his school, students, and style. And so when I say that, I mean, like, you know, it's kind of the ideal Kung Fu family where the Sifu takes care of the students, and he's very focused on the quality of students that he puts out. He has annual seminars around his birthday, so it's pretty fun. I was able to talk to Sifu Mark, who was a student or is a student of Sifu Augustine Fong, and he told me that it's around his birthday, so it's around May. And so what happens is all the old students come back for the seminar, they hang out, they eat, they have fun, they see each other again, you know what I mean, and they learn more about Wing Chun. It's a really good experience. And he told me that, you know, it's an expensive seminar, but, you know, for his students and for the people, basically the OGs, the people who have been there for a long time, he has no problem just taking what he needs and you know, not charging them the full price. He's a very good Sifu. He's vividly clear about his goals and intentions. If you have a chance, you should go onto his website and see a message from Sifu Fong. He talks about how he really cares about his students having a pure heart, which is the fun side. And on the other side, he talks about, you know, more stuff. Like, you know, anyone that said they train under me, it's, you know, it's great, but I'm not associated with that school. And I assume that that is because he's had some bad experiences before with some of his students. But anyways, this is a picture from the seminar last year. Everyone looks happy and healthy. But he has no young students, and he teaches Wing Chun in a very traditional way. And when I say traditional, I don't mean, you know, monks running up and down the mountain with water buckets on their shoulders. I mean that it's very boring, right? You got to sit there, you got to sit in a stance, you got to think about what you're doing. So he has a lot of adult students. Okay. And here's a quick clip from his seminar. I think it's kind of like an advertisement for the upcoming one. Everyone's welcome. So if you feel like going to Tucson, got a beautiful landscape out there.
When I have sinking elbow, my structure is very strong. And I have sinking bridge, I control the attack line. That's why he cannot go nowhere. He has to stick to my hand. I not allow him to move away from my hand. I'm not sticking to him, but I make him stick to me. That's what stick without sticking. The bottom line in Wing Chun is use the less effort to execute your goal. How you see the rock? Remember, sticky hand is not for fighting each other. It's to develop your own skill. That's the main thing.
He has it down. Whatever he's doing for his seminars, he has it down. He has a very organized schedule. It's all on his website. It's already predetermined, and it's expertly done. So I want you to keep that in mind. Kind of keep it in the back of your mind. And I'm going to talk about a couple other places in Tucson. Okay, so TCCC, the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center, and Our Lady of Lavang Church. Okay, the reason why I want to mention these two is that their focus definitely isn't Chinese Kung Fu. They have lion dancing and these types of activities as primarily ways to interact with the community. And so, like for example, for the church, they have lion dancing just to have for Lunar New Year, right? Because they have big Lunar Year, you know, festivities. All the Vietnamese Chinese communities come to the church, hang out, eat some food, see some performances and stuff, and things like that. Tucson Chinese Cultural Center is the same. And they're obviously there to serve the Chinese immigrant families or the Chinese American families that live in Tucson. And they have this activity kind of as a way for, you know, young people to kind of connect with the culture and, you know, as a way to do a cultural activity that's fun, that's, you know, that's more athletic than maybe sitting down and, you know, writing words or learning Chinese. Yeah, you know, the obviously the Chinese Cultural Center serves mostly Chinese families, and the church actually serves mostly Vietnamese families. But both of them interact so heavily with the local community. I mean, like, these guys, when they, like, I can't think of any Tucson venue that they haven't, or at least the TCCC, that they haven't performed at. They performed at the two casinos that exist in Tucson. They performed at, like, multiple Chinese restaurants and supermarkets, which is a lot in Tucson. There's only, like, two or three. So they do it a lot. You know, I mean, they have a lot of performances that they do. And ironically, even though they're... level of expertise is not at Sifu Augustine Fong's, both in Wing Chun both in Kung Fu and in specifically lion dancing, especially lion dancing. They still teach it, and the purpose for that is again to connect with the community around them. Right, that's the main purpose. Their purpose isn't to do Kung Fu. While Augustine Fong, on the other hand, is a complete opposite. His main purpose is Kung Fu, and has ironically been a little more, and is ironically a little more distant from the local community. I find that dynamic very interesting as someone who looks at communities like this, because you know, who doesn't want a good line dance for their business? You know what I mean?
So we spend a lot of time in a hot southern state, mm-hmm. Carbon state, and I mean it's hot.
Yeah.
You're in the car a lot.
Right.
Do other cultures have sort of a walk-by culture there? I mean, is there a distinction mm-hmm. between Chinese culture or the Asian culture and, you know, other Irish, although I know the Spanish-Mexican cultures.
Right, you mean in terms of...
Getting together.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the cultural difference is natural, like, because obviously he's, you know, these things are done in China, and then now they're trying to do them in America. But you know, it still works out, but it's a little different. Like, you know, they'll let people know ahead of time, like, oh, we're doing a performance of lion dance and kung fu at the casino 2 weeks from now, right? And so when people know about it, they'll go. But that's an interesting point. And I think we're going to touch on that a little bit later about the differences of culture.
Because where we are, the Latino culture is very much park-based. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter how hot it is.
Yeah.
They're in the park.
Right.
And we are in our air-conditioned conversation.
Right. Absolutely, no. I mean, and that's a good point because, but the interesting exception to that is that all of these performances are for... 95% of these performances are for Asian-based businesses or Asian-based organizations. And so even if they're not super familiar with the way it's supposed to be done, they're more familiar with it than people inviting the line dance troupe to go to a park. But I'm sure they would do it. But on the same token, like, you know, with the local people that are not Chinese, would they know about line dancing? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know if they would necessarily request that. But but yeah, definitely, like, there's definitely a cultural, you know, difference there. Yeah. All right. So, another fun question. For this one, let's do partners again. Give you guys a minute to talk about it. What do you think is required for Kung Fu School to be financially successful? And what are some of the challenges that come with your requirements? All right. So did anyone have anything interesting that their partner said or that they thought of?
I just know it's on paper.
Anyone want to volunteer an answer?
The old traditional schools were not about money.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I first started, there was only a few different colors of belts, mm-hmm. you know, a white, a brown, you know, like that.
Right.
And a lot of the schools developed all of these different colors of belts,
mm-hmm.
and we used to refer to that as the belt factories, because yeah. they would have all the kids going through there, and every 2 weeks mm-hmm. you'd get a new color of belt, and every
Absolutely.
Time they got a new color of belt, they had to pay more, you mm-hmm. know, and... they had the financial economics
right.
Done,
right.
Pretty much figured out. Some of the old traditional schools had a lot of problems
right.
with the finances because it wasn't about the money. It was about we're going to do it the traditional way.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a long time. This may take you 15 years to accomplish something that you could accomplish in 1 year at a belt factory.
Right,
you know,
right.
like that. So... the other thing that I noticed, and I noticed this in Chinatown, and I really mm-hmm. respect this, at Chinese New Year, at the Lunar New Year, they do the line dance.
Right.
A lot of the dojos come around and do the line dance, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of the merchants support the dojos
yeah.
to come to their place of business and do the line dance mm-hmm. for good luck for their business.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And I think that is an amazing model
mm-hmm.
for them to support the dojo, because a lot of businesses that don't actually patronize the dojo itself,
right.
Like they don't go to classes there, they pay because every year they want that lion to come to their business
right.
and give
right.
them good luck. And I, when we go down to Chinatown for New Year's,
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm looking for. I want
Absolutely.
To watch that. Yeah.
Man, that's one of the next parts of the presentation. You might as well write the whole thing yourself. All right. Is that?
Yeah. in our partner discussion, it was mm-hmm. more about how do we keep the students at the school.
Right.
So how do we keep them motivated? You know, mm-hmm. maybe it's through competitions and like that.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, so keeping the young people motivated, local businesses supporting the school.
Also know that you get good pay when you perform the line dance.
Right.
So if you perform a lot, that's one of your financial income.
Absolutely, absolutely. That is the most New York answer we could have gotten. All right. And
we talked about developing partnerships with different organizations, mm-hmm. with police departments and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, absolutely.
Self-defense, women empowerment,
yeah.
things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do that especially in San Francisco because, again, they have a very heavy Chinese-American influence. And the SFPD actually, for the Chinese New Year Parade, has a line dance troupe. Crazy. You don't see that anywhere else in America.
We were saying that reputation has a lot to do with it. Whether or not the school is actually reputable or where the student is trained,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What stuff they've been in, and
right.
whether or not they're trackable. There's a handful of schools here in Europe where some Sikhs have either been in movies or they've been contributing to the community in some kind of way.
Right, right, absolutely, absolutely. Well, those are all good answers. See, I told you, everyone had different answers. That was awesome. That was awesome. I should be able to teach a class on this pretty soon. All right. So now we're moving a little further east. Okay, we're going to Texas, Houston. Thank you. So I talked to Sifu Mark for Tucson. And crazy enough, there's another Sifu Mark from Houston. And they really took the time out to talk to me, and I really appreciate that. Houston is probably one of the more diverse areas in Texas. And it has a 6% Asian population, which totals out around 130,000. Not super small. And also has a pretty large martial arts scene. It's definitely more than you would think. I think the I don't know if he was exaggerating, but Coach Mark was telling me that they had about like 10 other line dance troops that they had to compete with. And, you know. All right, so this is super interesting. The Qiujiao Association. Okay. So the lion dance team, or the kung fu school itself, resides inside a temple. It's inside the Qiujiao Association temple, okay. And this temple has both Vietnamese and Chinese speakers. And I know it's hard to see, but even on the front of it, it has Vietnamese on the right and Chinese on the left. Okay. So for those who don't know, the Qiujiao people are people, you know, whose origins are in Qiujiao, and they're from Canton, but. Notably, a lot of the Chaozhou people are all around the world, but they're notably also in Vietnam. And so I'm assuming that's probably why they also have a very heavy Vietnamese influence for the temple. Okay, this is a nonprofit organization, and so we're gonna see a quick clip of their line dance team, and I want you to. Kind of pay attention to the details, just not of the movement, just of the whole video, just like the people and their clothes and stuff like that. As you can see, they have some very pretty lions, which means what? Anyone can tell me what that means?
Money.
Yep, they're expensive. Okay. I don't know if you can tell, but the equipment is also very nice. The flags are very nice. They all have a pretty nice uniform. Those things cost money. And aside from that, I don't know if you guys can tell, but their skill level is also pretty high. You know, the coordination, the drumming itself, how it's consistent. All those things are pretty, you know, those are pretty difficult things to obtain. It takes a lot of time to get those, okay? So, this is where the fun part happens. The line dance team actually preceded the temple. The temple was built in 1995, and the line dance team was in 1994. And at that time, it was very few members. And that's kind of what caught my interest about them, was I remember seeing videos of them before, and it was kind of a typical mom and pop kung fu situation where the sifu was drumming, the wife maybe was on the gong, and then another student there, and it had like a one lion type of thing, right? Not that many people were there for it. And now they have a really strong number of 25 members. That means 25 consistent people for the performance team. Okay, that's a lot of people. And the team, again, operates completely within the temple. They only practice once a week. They only practice once a week, and they do kung fu too. And, you know, I mean, you know, I think, especially since they're practicing once a week, they're quite good. And they only practice for like 4 or 5 hours, which sounds like a lot, but for the whole week, it's not a lot, and they're pretty good. So what's interesting about this is the success of this team, right? Because really, you can look at this, Qizhou Temple, you can look at the Qizhou Temple kind of similar to the TCCC, or the church that we just talked about. But yet, instead of the organization kind of restricting the growth of the line dance team or of the martial arts team, it actually encouraged it. I imagine that this group utilized a lot of the resources from the temple to grow themselves, right? Because if you're a businessman, you're already going to the temple. And it's like, oh, you know, I kind of open a new business. Maybe, you know, I heard that they do line dancing. Why not have a line dance at my place, right? Because it's, you know, it's fun, drums up, you know, attention, and, you know, of course, it's good luck, right? And so really the success of this team is very interesting because it really happened in relationship to the temple. It wasn't just on its own. It's not a, you know, they don't do this full time. Coach Mark has another job that he complains to me about pretty often. But they all have lives aside from the temple, right? These guys are really, really excellent for the amount of time that they're spending practicing. Okay. All right, so another fun question. This one, I'm going to call on people. No need to talk to a partner. In terms of urban, suburban, or countryside, which area do you think is most complementary toward the development and sustainability of a kung fu school? This should be pretty fun. Because you can make arguments for all of them.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in, of course, the reasoning behind it. Yeah. Anyone have anything they want to say off the top of their head?
Yeah, I was in Atlanta for 10 months, like 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. Atlanta was interesting because Chinese community is extremely spread out.
Mm-hmm.
But the Taiwan government gave them money to build a Chinese community center.
Oh.
And that made all the difference for the Chinese community. Everyone drives a car and they go there.
Right.
Even for the weekend.
Right.
And without that, it wouldn't happen. So I would say that in that case, it worked.
Right, right.
We'll just go to our place on the weekend.
I see.
Schools and dance, everything happened in that one center.
Okay, so would you say suburban then?
Suburban more,
yeah.
Can be very successful if someone is willing to build.
Okay, cool. Anyone others have? Yeah.
Pretty much think that if you build like maybe a kung fu school in the countryside, it may be successful because in the countryside, most people are familiar with each other.
Right, right.
And if you can establish a kung fu school and go, you know, get interest in it, probably many people who live amongst themselves participate there, they'll work together for health purposes. Mm-hmm. It'll probably be a good medium for maybe developing more support.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, like you said, the relationship, right, is like, man, you've been skipping school, you got to go to Joe's Kung Fu, you know, like, you know, you just got to go, okay? So, like, you know, that familiarity might have, it might be easier for it to kind of, you know, be known in the community and for people to go to. And it's probably easier to kind of gauge what people want to, just because they're so close to everybody. Any other ones?
I think it really depends on what you mean by development and sustainability.
Right.
Because when you think about like the cost, how much it costs to actually open and operate a school, and to maintain, you know, the equipment, to get the drum sets, to get uniforms, and so on and so forth, it might be really good in an urban environment to agree.
Right.
So priced out by, you know, the Starbucks or whatever.
Right.
Whereas, you know, in the suburban area in the countryside, because it does have a lot more community involvement, it has the potential to be more successful in that respect because it involves more people sort of pitching it.
Yeah, definitely.
That's my take on it.
Yeah, and you make a good point because, you know, I mean, people don't think about the cost of equipment, right? I mean, when you're at New York or San Francisco or LA, like somewhere where it's on the coast, boom, you got it in a shipping container, it's there, right? But what if you live, in Iowa? Whew. Can you imagine shipping a linehead? I have tried once. It is over $1,000 because of how big it is and how, because it's fragile, right? So it's awkward for the mailman to deliver. Yeah, the drums, exactly, yeah. But, you know, obviously the lion head's a little scarier because, you know, the guy can, like, kick in and then, oh, there goes the cheek, you know. So, yeah, so that's a very good point. Any other things that you guys might have any thoughts on? No? Okay. Poem. New York City, we're here. We're in the East Coast. It's raining. You know, New York City has a huge diversity of kung fu, and it has a huge, you know, martial diversity, really. I mean, like, even in terms of Muay Thai, MMA, and all that stuff, you have probably some of the best gyms in New York City. And I don't know about the statistic. The census told me this statistic. You know, anyways, so there's around 1 million Asian people in New York City, and about 800,000 are Chinese. That's a pretty big percentage. So, interestingly, so I've been citing specific places for, you know, all of my presentation, but for this one, we're going to be talking about lion dance as a whole, okay? And I found, maybe it's just because of my personal experience, I found that lion dance in New York City is especially relevant in the kung fu scene. During Chinese New Year, they block off, the Saturday after Lunar New Year, they block off the streets so that all these troops can go in and do lion dance and do the choi tang, which is the blessing for the businesses. And it's crazy. Like, they have so many troops there. Even myself, I've seen about 20 of them. That's nuts. And I'm just interested, you know, I hear the drum, like, oh, you know, go over there, check it out. But it's so many different groups, it's crazy. As you would expect in most, you know, urban areas, most of the people that do lion dance are Chinese American. I think that lion dance is naturally easier to contribute to community stuff because you in kung fu, you could be a hermit and just kind of practice on your own in a cellar or something or in a cave. You know what I mean? But lion dance, you need to go out to perform. You need to. There's no if, and, or buts about it. And it's also good because you have to work together. This dude could be a total, like, he could be the worst person you've ever talked to, but he could practice kung fu on his own. You can't do that when you're in a lion dance team. Because you gotta work together with everybody, right? And through that, I think also performing for, especially for young people and even for adults, it's fun to do things together. It kind of creates that bond a lot easier, right? So in terms of its contributed community, like you said, they do a lot of blessings, right? And it's very, I think it's very interesting how widespread it is. One of the, praying mantis schools, I saw them in Manhattan. Cool. Awesome. Right? Saw them 8th Avenue. Wow. All the way out here, huh? And, I'm sorry, 8th Avenue, Brooklyn. 8th Avenue, Brooklyn. Wow, all the way out here. And then I saw them in Avenue U, Brooklyn, which is super deep into Brooklyn. I'm like, what are you even doing here? I'm just going grocery shopping, right? So these guys really go out of their way to do the blessings. And I think that it's a big part of the kung fu culture here because really that's the only time you can do it. You know, I mean, it's Lunar New Year. So I'm sure they're getting, you know, they're like just going to as many places as they can. Okay. And the second place I want to talk about is PS 130, which is near Chinatown. I believe it's Sifu Stanley Moy and his son that run a lion dance program in PS 130. And I think it's super cool because you're teaching the kids lion dance. They're having a good time. It's fun, like community building. It's fun, you know, just to do things together as a group. And you know, for in terms of the kung fu aspect of it, you don't have to worry too much about finding students. Right? They're gonna be there for you and you can focus purely on just enjoying the teaching or enjoying, you know, the lion dance itself. And so I thought that was really interesting. But PS 130 isn't the only school that does that. I've seen a lot of videos and I've talked to a lot of people that do performances in schools, in public schools. And the kids love it. You know what I mean? So I think that this is a very special part of New York City kung fu scene is that how involved lion dance is with the schools, with really the people. It's crazy. And I think it's really cool. Also, fun fact, a lot of the, at least the ones I've seen, a lot of the line dance teams, they have more traditional Fatsan style line dancing, which I think is very particular. And there's a lot of, like I said, a lot of teams, which again is very particular because in San Francisco, it's dominated by two or three line dance teams, Leung's White Crane and Yao Gongmun, YKM. And they do the Malaysian style line dancing, understandably so, because they compete a lot. And so, the traditional side of it isn't as emphasized, right? But these, but the ones in New York City, almost all do traditional style when they do the blessings, right? So I thought that was pretty cool, and it's pretty, very interesting, very particular to New York City or New York.
Did you have any idea how many different line dance troupes actually exist in, let's say, Chinatown, especially during the Lunar New Year? Because when you're there, there's one over here, and then you
right.
walk a half a block, and there's another one there, and then another one. It seems like there's quite a few.
Yeah, there's quite a few. And what's interesting about that is actually Chinatown has restricted the admittance of new groups into line dancing in China because there's just too many, I think, anyway. A lot of the groups, they kind of combine sometimes. They like wear one group's uniforms so they can go on line dance. And so I don't know specifically, but it's a lot. Alright, so this is a quick video that someone from the Brooklyn Line Club took while he was in Manhattan Chinatown for what he called Super Saturday, which is where they block off the streets and all the line dance troops go to their line dance. So even in that video, there's already like three or four groups, right? So, and in the video is a little longer. There's a couple more groups that show up, but the point is to show kind of how many people are there and how popular it is as a line dance troupe.
Color scheme significant?
So traditionally, yes. To be honest, I think traditionally you're not supposed to have a white or black lion for Chinese New Year. White is usually for death, and so they have funeral lions. They you guys know the Kung Fu star Lao Galing, the Hong Ga guy. Anyways, when he passed away, he had a lion dance for his funeral, and they're all white lions, and that's the sign of mourning. Black, it's not horrible, but it's usually associated with gang stuff, underground stuff. Again, not the best for Chinese New Year. Usually, red, yellow is more ideal. Ooh, we are running low on time. How do you think certain aspects of American lifestyle might affect the operation of a Kung Fu school? I'll just take two people and then we'll move on. And I'm going to give you a cute example that related to my introduction after this.
A lot of moving around. So, a lot of Americans, relocate.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. I never even thought about that. Give this man a scholarship.
With the prevalence of UFC gyms and Thai boxing in MMA, it's really affecting Kung Fu school attendance because it's not deemed as practical.
Right.
There is a lot more cultural aspects to it than some other really, really solid exercise within respective Kung Fu schools.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely a good one. My fun fact, is eating. The eating culture here is very different, right? What time does your favorite place usually close? 10, 11? In China, a lot of the places don't close. And even at the Sunwood School that I did my research at, there was a saying, sit ye zhou, which is eating late night kanji, right? And that's a big part of doing kung fu. It means that you've earned the food because you practice so hard. And whether or not you earn or not, not the point. But the point is that you're able to go out to eat and socialize after you practice. When I practice out here, and if it's late at night, you go to a bodega, corner store, make an egg and cheese, but You know what I mean? It's not the same, right? You don't get to sit down and hang out, right? Yeah. So, real quickly, we're going to go to San Antonio, Chile, South America, all right? 88,000 total population in San Antonio. Could not find the Asian percentage. Possibly zero. And there's a pretty significant interest in Kung Fu or Choi Li Fut in Chile, surprisingly. Or not surprisingly, and I'll get to that. I'm just going to call it Choi Li Fut San Antonio, because I can't pronounce the first two. But the head instructor at this school is Mauricio Gallego. And what's interesting is that he's actually a baker by, that's his means of financial support. He's a baker. And he has his school part-time with his son, Javier, who is a law professor. Yeah, crazy. Anyway, so the point is that, you know, it's part-time, right? But they still have a pretty good amount of students. And they maintain a solid 20 to 30 students all the time, which is pretty good. And when I asked them about, you know, their involvement in the community, why people go there and stuff like that, they talked about really they're kind of a center for Chinese culture because, you know, even though they're not Chinese, they have more, they've spent more time delving into the Chinese subjects than their peers. And a lot of the people, you know, they watch movies or they heard about Kung Fu and they think it's very interesting and they go here to learn about it. And so it's kind of like a place to learn about Chinese culture. And of course he talked about some of the goals of the students there. More typical stuff for the kids, you know, they want them to do discipline, learn how to protect themselves, exercise, typical stuff like that. And the older students are into the kickboxing, like, you know, the more combat heavy stuff. And the older students are just into health, usually, or just as another fun activity. This is connected to the mother school of Choi Li Fut in Santiago, Chile. And the mother school is run by a sifu named Raul, I believe, and he's an official disciple of Chen Yongfa, who is the successor of the Choi Li Fut style. So it's a pretty significant thing, and I believe that, you know, his level must be pretty good in order to manage these different schools. But the point is that this is connected to that school, and that school is in Santiago, which I believe is a more urban area, more populated area, and so that's probably why Choi Li Fut is a little more popular there than, you know, in other places. Hierarchy is interesting because this school, and the two instructors there, Javier and Mauricio, are they go to the main school in Santiago to receive kind of like the formal okay. Like they go there, you know, to become certified instructors. They go there to do this and that to kind of, that's kind of like, they're kind of like the offspring of that school. So I thought that was pretty interesting too, because, you know, like I said, it was I couldn't even find an Asian population percentage for this area, and yet they're still able to do that. All right, this is a fun one. How has technology changed the way that people interact with martial arts?
Do you did you just see what Colin McGregor did?
Yeah,
what is that, a dolly through a window?
Yeah, updated news, 24/7, easy to find. He did it in Brooklyn, but you can see it probably in Australia, you know, at the same, you know, within an hour.
Recently, I needed to see the 118 Tai Chi move, mm-hmm. and all I have to do is go to YouTube and pull it up, and there it is.
Right. So. Access to videos is super, super important for the Kung Fu, or I mean, actually for a lot of things, but especially Kung Fu, because people can see you do your stuff. Sifu, or let's say Raymond Fong performance. Oh my goodness, he's trash. Never gonna learn from him. New York Lion Dance. Oh my goodness, that's beautiful. Let me use it for my presentation. This is a very big part of what Kung Fu is today. Any other
forums where people all over the world who are into martial arts can talk, yeah, share information, or debate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I see that. Sifu Raul, the only reason why I know his name is because he added me on Facebook, right? And that connects you in a way where it's, you know, it's definitely less awkward. It's like if me and you do Choi Li Fut, it's like, hey, you know, I'm coming to New York City, let's go out to eat, you know what I mean?
Social media, World Tai Chi Day has become more and more popular because,
yeah,
now you go to Central Park on World Tai Chi Day and it's packed.
Right.
Because everybody can communicate.
Absolutely. Ease of communication is a big one, right? Because it's like, oh, the time is changing. Boom. 8 p.m. But like, you don't need to pass out 800 different flyers, right? You can just throw it up there. That's a huge thing. Yeah.
Yeah, American lifestyle, you move to the next town, you just look up, just Google, you know, teaching the town.
Yep.
So the advertising website is huge for the organization.
Absolutely, absolutely. Any other fun things?
Those are all positive things.
Yeah.
The record of trollage has exponentially grown and has increased the amount of trash talking across the board for different schools.
Absolutely, absolutely. Those keyboard warriors, man. Oh man, it's rough. It is rough. And then they think they also think and when you disable the comments, that also restricts a medium for people to communicate with you. So that's annoying as well. Like when you're trying to block out trolls. I have a lot of experience. We're gonna move on. So the next two are gonna be actually the two deeper subjects of my research, because I actually. These two topics were my research topic. Like these were something that I really delved deep into. We are kind of limited on time, so I'm gonna try to breeze through them as quickly as possible, because I do want to give you guys a chance to talk to me about whatever. I love talking about kung fu. You talk to me about anything about kung fu. But so Sun Wui Chou Li Fut Ancestral Association. This is in Canton, in Sun Wui, obviously, and it's about a maybe like 4 or 5 hour bus ride from Hong Kong. Pretty close. And a 2-hour bus ride from Guangzhou. Not too bad. Anyways, this is the mother school of Chou Li Fut. This is literally where the founder, Chun Heng, founded Chou Li Fut. And this is where he was born. What's interesting about this is that it's run, and you'll see why this is interesting in the next slide. It's run as a business. So people come in, they pay the instructors for their kids to learn. They started to have like little summer camps and stuff like that. And they also do line dance. And they're probably one of the best line dance troops. As you can see with how many people are going out to perform, they're one of the best line dance troops in Canton. And they get paid pretty handsomely for the performances. A lot of work though. The performances are hour long. And if you've ever line danced, it's rough. So they have like 3 or 4 line dance routines, 3 or 4 kung fu segments, and then they have the last one, the finale, which is a zhong, which is the plum blossom poles, Malaysian style, where they jump and you know it's really dangerous. So they're very professional in that sense. So what's interesting too is that they kind of have a interesting balance between traditional and contemporary. The school here receives money from a fund called the Non-Material Cultural Heritage Fund in China. And the point is that because Chun Heng, or the founder, was smart enough to write everything down, they have records that they have cultural significance in that area. And so they receive money from the government to maintain those cultural traditions, to maintain, you know, everything. And so I think most of that money goes to the Ancestral Hall, which is technically the OG school, but no one goes there to practice. Everyone goes there for, like, ritual things, like to pay respect to the founder, to just do those things. This school technically is in the city area of Sun Wui, and while the Ancestral School is in the village area. Okay, so... So traditional, contemporary, they have a lot of contemporary training methods. So they use a lot of wushu training methods. They do the Malaysian style line dancing, but they also emphasize the traditional aspect of it, where like, you know, you the sifu part of it, where it's like your sifu for life type of thing. And there's a very, you know, more of a si hing, si jie, or like the, you know, kung fu brother and sister, kung fu family type relationship that still exists here very strongly. But you know, it's not necessarily it's changing. It's definitely different from what you would imagine a traditional school would be. Okay. So we're gonna play a quick clip of one of their bigger performances that I caught a little bit of while I was there. Unfortunately, the shot's not amazing, but bear with me. GoPros have amazing quality. It's just I realized that my filming isn't up to that quality. Thank you. can see, they're very professional. They have a big team. They go out to perform for big things. This is a village that hired them to go out to their village. So that's a very expensive. It's probably around, I think, 20,000-30,000 RMB. Because the performances are very long and they're very comprehensive. Anyways, so yeah. So again, in terms of the community, like they rely on their own. They first relied on their own community. All the local banks in some way all hit them up, right? That's how they started growing. They got better slowly, and now they're sought after by other villages. We went to, which is a different village, Toisan, like 3 times, and you know, this is another one that we went to, and they have like 2 or 3 performances every day for about 2 or 3 weeks. Very, very draining, very difficult. My friend, who is one of the tails for Lion, hurt his back. Like it's rough, right? So the money that you're paying, sure, you know, it's a lot of money, but it's also a lot of effort that they have to put out in order for you to have that performance. And cool enough, there is actually a Sifu. Okay, so also the kids that you saw are mostly, you know, they're intermediate beginner level kids that, you know, that perform usually. Mostly the people who are better, they kind of save their competency for more important things, right? And so actually one of the Sifus who contributed to the success of this school is here in New York, in Brooklyn. And I think, yep, there's a video of him I have. This is in 2010 Hong Kong. Interested? Hit him up. He's out here. Yeah. Okay. So again, this is a big part of my research. The Chongqing Provincial Wushu Team. So Wushu, in the American sense, okay, Wushu, the performance kung fu, is a sport in China. It's a sport, and they have teams that represent different parts, you know, of the country. The lower level ones are district, you know, regional like that. The provincial teams are the highest level. And the only team, like, or maybe only level above them is like the Beijing Wushu team. But even then, a lot of them, they outsource their training to other provincial Wushu teams. So this is probably the highest level of Wushu that you can access. It was a really crazy experience going to train with them. They have a very rigorous training schedule, and it's grueling. It's 6 hours a day, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, and 2 hours at night. And then every other day you have to run. And then on Saturdays, they lift weights. So it's a very, very rigorous training regimen. And there is, funny enough, nothing stereotypically traditional in the way that they train. Everything is modern. Push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, again, weights. You know, most traditional Chinese kung fu does not do weights, do not do push-ups and stuff like that. They do heavy, heavy conditioning with acrobatic movements and... You know, some of the disciplinary methods are hard for Americans to see, and it's kind of like the price you have to pay for greatness type of thing. It's very difficult for the young people that are in the team. A lot of these people come from backgrounds where they didn't have a lot of money, and the Wushu team. If you get onto the Wushu team, the provincial Wushu team, you're kind of like. You shoot up in terms of financial stability. It's very, very financially stable. My friends that I knew from a long time ago and I've been talking to and visited last year, they own an apartment, and they're younger than me. They allow them to own an apartment and a car, which in China, I mean, it's not like amazing. Now you're making like crazy amounts of money, but you're making a good amount of money, especially coming from some of the families that these kids came from. And like I said, it's very contemporary. So everything is government funded. They live, sleep, and eat government everything. They eat in a cafeteria. They eat, you know, they sleep in like kind of dorm like, you know, rooms. And it's very interesting. I don't think anyone has ever done research on this before. Don't steal my idea, whoever's watching. Don't steal my idea. But yeah, this is, you know, it's very interesting. And for this specific team, they used to train on an island isolated from the rest of the city so that the kids wouldn't mess around on the weekend, right? And yeah, it was pretty. It's very grueling. Even now they're at what they call a college town or a college city, a 中国城. Okay, Daihoxing, and it's like a collection of athletes that train there, eat there, do everything there, and they're part of them. But it's again isolated from a lot of the luxuries of being free. It's kind of like a prison, So yeah, let's watch a quick video. This is actually my friend. I don't even think he won. I think he won second or third place. He didn't even win first place, but this was, yeah. And you'll see why this is a performance martial art because of how good it looks. Yeah, so you know that's a level that I had an opportunity to see. It's mind blowing because you know when you're watching the video, it's slow already, right? It's always slower in the video, and so when you go there and see them live, like to see that level of perfection in their movements, it's crazy. It's a completely different experience. And actually, you know, in America, where you were talking about how kind of kung fu has to you know prove itself in terms of combat, this and that, in China that doesn't exist because. Regardless of whether you combat or not, do you blame basketball players for not being able to fight? No. It's the same thing with this. Regardless of whether you're fighting or not, you're putting yourself through 6 hours of grueling training. Obviously, he's very fit, right? He's very strong, very fit. So that kind of dynamic doesn't even exist in China. So coming back to what I was talking about earlier, so if you compare these two things, right? This is the opposite of the Sun Wei Chole Fut ancestral school. This is not even close to a business, right? This is completely government funded. The Sun Wei Chole Fut one is the opposite. It's actually, the Chole Fut one is actually more similar to an American model of terms of like having a school, having people come and learn from you, they pay money. It's a very more normal type of situation. This, on the other hand, is completely different. And that's why I wanted to do research on this initially, because I feel like very few people know about this. And this is not, and also the community, or in terms of the, yeah, I guess the community that the Wushu teams are part of is not necessarily a Kung Fu community. They're more part of the athlete community. So they know a lot of people that do Taekwondo, a lot of people that do badminton, a lot of people that do basketball, whatever it is, right? They're more of that part of that athlete community. And with that, the culture changes, right? And it's not bad or good. It's just the way that they live and the things that they've had to go through for training. It's very different. While the other side is more traditional in the sense that they have lives aside from the Kung Fu school. The Wushu is their life. For Chole Fut, the Kung Fu is kind of, you know, it might be a way of life. And it might be a way that to make their financial, you know, goals, but it's not like this. It's very different, okay? And this one has very little, obviously, very little relationship to the local community. They don't even have a local community because they're usually isolated from the rest of it.
How many people show up to the competition?
Competition?
Or the performance.
Competitions, yeah.
Do they fill an arena?
Absolutely. Oh, you mean for spectators?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's full, but it's about half full all the time because it's the same people, right? It's the people who are competing, the rest of the team, the coaches, and that's pretty much it. It doesn't really waver. So this isn't consumed as like a leisure activity. This is purely
government motivation and funding.
It's a sport, and they believe that sports is under their umbrella. They want their athletes to have all the funding or whatever because I think anyway, in their perspective, the when the athlete brings home gold, it reflects very well in the government, and so they tried. They take it onto themselves to kind of fund that. Oh yeah. So anyway, no local community. They're completely isolated for so long. While the Choliphat is actually the opposite, where they rely very heavily on the local community to kind of platform off and do the things they need to do. So, whew, cutting it close. Conclusion. For about the conclusion. So, one of the main points of this talk is to talk about Kung Fu today. Right? I feel like a lot of people, when I see a lot of presentations and written literature about Kung Fu, people talk about the past. People talk about the 1960s, they talk about Wong Fei-Hung, they talk about Fought Yun Gap, you know, and Fearless, or whatever it might be, or Ip Man, you know what I mean? But very few people talk about Kung Fu today. And there's a lot of interesting things happening in Kung Fu today, right? You have nonprofit organizations with close to professional level line dance teams. You have Chongqing, Wushu teams in China killing themselves to make their moves perfect. And you have the Sun Wei Chole Fut school in Canton, you know, doing line dance to sustain themselves, right? While also receiving money from the government and expanding in a capitalist way in a not so capitalist area. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting things that are happening in Kung Fu today, and I just really wanted to bring that to the forefront, and I wanted people to start talking about it because it's interesting. I feel like, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that I just brought up in this presentation. Relationship between communities. As an anthropologist, you got to see what's around, what's going on. It's never an isolated thing. Kung Fu schools shape their communities, and communities shape their Kung Fu schools. Without the Vietnamese and Chinese population in Houston, Texas, where would the Chujo Temple be? Where would the team be? Okay. In terms of Augustine Fong, where would he be if he didn't have a strong information dissemination? If people didn't know about him, how are they going to go to his school, right? These are very important dynamics to analyze, and it's very important not to look at one thing as just one thing. It's always, you know, the things that surround it that influence what they are as well. Last point, why does this matter? Education and social dynamics. I think it's important to know that Kung Fu is not just exercise. It's not just spiritual development. It's not just fighting. There's a lot of different social aspects to Kung Fu that people should take advantage of. And I think some people do without even knowing it. When kids go into Kung Fu, they don't just learn Kung Fu. They make friends, right? They do lion dance. They learn about the culture. They do a whole different things, right? A whole bunch of different things, you know? And I just really want people to see that other side of Kung Fu that really isn't focused on too much, at least from what I've seen. And if you have any questions, just want to talk to me or whatever, that's my email, rf2528@tc.columbia.edu. Before I end, really big thank you to Sifu Huang Zhenqing for hooking me up in the Choli Fut back in China. Big thank you to Coach Mark and Sifu Mark for interviewing with me. And who was I talking? Oh, big thank you to Sifu Javier, or I don't know if he's a Sifu. To Javier, great friend, and you know, thanks to you guys for giving me all your time. I hope you know, this inspires you to look at Kung Fu a little differently, and I hope you see you guys again. Thank you.